The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning and welcome to the March term of court held here at the School of Law on the campus of the University of South Dakota. We have available a publication in the lobby, which is a photographic history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Tells you a little bit about the institution all the way back to territorial days up to the present. And also, while we no longer publish it in paper, we do have synopses of the 8 cases we'll be hearing for oral argument this term on the internet. The first case for oral argument this morning is the Bradley Piper Appellant versus State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Steve Miller, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee, we have Attorney General Marty Jackley and Paul Swedlund, an Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Swedlund, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very well. Mr. Miller, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I have not appeared in front of this court since April of 2009, and that was in the Piper 2 case. That was up in Pier. And I'm going to take care of this right now. In April 2009, I introduced you to my youngest son, who was there to see his father in action. And today I'd like to introduce you to my oldest son, who is a senior at University of South Dakota. And his name is Ross Miller, and he is embarrassed right up there. So I've got the father thing out of the way. I'm not going to focus today on the facts of this case. It's a tragic case. And if I start focusing on the facts, I will get lost. But we are not here to talk about the facts, at least as to the primary issue. It's purely a question of law. There are a couple of subsidiary questions that are just kind of floating in the background here that no one has addressed in the briefs. But I am sure they're in the back of your minds as they are in the back of mine. The first is, what kind of respect do you think you deserve? Not what kind of respect you do deserve, but what kind of respect does this court think its opinions deserve? When you said in Piper 2, admittedly it was not an issue in front of you, but you went out of the way to write this. When you said in Piper 2 that I can't seem to find it now, but that a plea cannot be considered valid without understanding of that unanimity advice, did you mean it or didn't you? When you said a paragraph later, see also, and you cited 3 cases, all of which dealt with the validity of guilty pleas, not subsidiary waivers or later waivers, but guilty pleas themselves, why did you put that in the opinion? Why is that language there if you didn't mean to have it followed? Now, there are 2 options. There are 2 alternatives as to how me, the observer, can view your language. Number one, you were blowing smoke up our nostrils. You didn't really mean it. And if we, later on, decide to disregard it, thinking, ugh, it's just something they said, well, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is you put it in your opinion because you meant it. And you expected it to be followed. Now, I could have rested my brief on that one statement in your opinion. And the argument essentially would have been, well, here's why you reverse, because you said so. However, I have raised 2 teenage sons, and because you said so is hardly a persuasive argument to teenage sons, and it's not really a persuasive argument to you. And so in my brief, I go into the reasons why what you said was legally correct. In fact, it's legally necessary. In our system of justice, based on our Constitution, the highest document we have, the thing that protects all of us from people in power, in our system of justice, a judge's sentencing jurisdiction, you were all circuit court judges at one time, I used to appear in front of you. Your sentencing jurisdiction does not exist unless there is first a valid determination of guilt. And in our system of justice, there are two ways to get a valid determination of guilt. The default position is a jury trial with all of the procedural protections that go along with it. If I'm a defendant standing in front of you and you ask me how I plead and I just give you a blank stare and don't say a thing, a not guilty plea is entered on my behalf and a jury trial is going to happen because that's the default position. The Constitution protects that whole process. The alternative is if I waive my right to a jury trial, and if I plead guilty instead. The guilty plea is the waiver, but that's the alternative way of determining guilt. And the Constitution protects that determination just as rigorously as it protects the trial determination. And the reason for that is very simple. Before the awesome power of the state is harnessed against an individual for any serious offense, forget the fact for a minute that this is a death penalty case. Let's say it's for felony drunk driving, before the awesome power of the state can be harnessed against that individual to brand him as a felon, the Constitution levels the playing field by granting a bunch of protections. And in a guilty plea context, the protections have been in place for decades, for over a century. Those protections are that before Briley Piper's choice to plead guilty, made back in 2001, can be forever held against him, it must be true that when he entered that plea, not at some later time, but that when he entered that plea, he was given correct advice as to the rights he had and the fact he was waiving them. Now, this court today, as we stand here today, this court has twice held that the information that he had was not correct. The first time you held that was in 2006, 5 years after his plea, when you said, no, it is not true that what he thought was not true. What he thought was that the adjudicator of guilt or innocence had to be the same adjudicator for the penalty. If I plead guilty, I must have judge sentencing. If I go to jury trial, I must have jury sentencing. No, that's not true, said this court, because our holding today is necessary to make our death penalty statutes constitutional. Now, I'm not here to dispute that. Personally, I don't like it because I'm anti-death penalty, but that has nothing to do with anything here today. Legally, you had to do what you did in order to uphold the constitutionality of the statutes, and of course, that's your job. You don't want to slap the legislature in the face. Your job is to uphold those statutes if you can. And you found a way to do that, and I am not disputing that one bit. But let me tell you just a little vignette about what happened in 2006. I got appointed in May to represent Mr. Piper in the habeas case. This court knows me. I've been around a long time. You know I read your opinions with a critical eye, and I don't mean critical like, you know, I disagree with you, although sometimes I do. I mean critical, that's what I do for a living. And so I read your opinions, I analyze your opinions, I think about your opinions. I do that every week, every Thursday on the internet. I got the Briley Piper opinion in January of 2006, and I let it sit for about a week because it was long and I didn't have the time and I just didn't have the energy. And I finally read it. And here's what I thought. In 1986, I did a death penalty defense in Minnehaha County, a trial defense. And although it wasn't an issue back then, I studied the death penalty statutes, and I had concluded in my own mind the same thing that his lawyers had concluded, which is guilty plea, judge sentencing, jury trial, jury sentencing. That's what I had concluded. And so when I read your opinion, I thought, oh, I guess I was wrong. That's why I remember it, because I guess I was wrong. And then my very next thought was this. Well, you know, that's good and well. The Supreme Court can do whatever they want to. I understand why they're trying to uphold statutes. That makes perfect sense to me. But tell me this. How does what the five of you decided in 2006 affect the validity of a plea that was entered 5 years earlier? The validity of the plea has nothing to do with what you say 5 years later. It has everything to do with what he was told 5 years earlier. That was my first thought. And then I get appointed on the case, and of course you know what happened. Piper 2 came down the pike where that issue gets raised, and then it gets sent back, where you say specifically, The plea cannot be considered to be voluntary and intelligent without an understanding of that concept of unanimity. And why is that true? Why is that true about the guilty plea as opposed to just the jury waiver of sentencing? It's true because of the reasons I explained in the first brief. Those two things were inextricably linked in Mr. Piper's mind. Here is what he knew from the judge's advice, not just the attorney's advice. I will let you deal with the state's brief. I'm not even going to comment on that. But with the judge's advice, he knew that if he insisted on his right to a jury trial on guilt or innocence, he had to be sentenced by a jury. He knew that. He also knew, based on what the judge told him, based on what the judge told him, he also knew that he'd have to convince all 12 of those jurors. Now, his lawyers had told him different. We know that. But when it came down to it, when the bad advice came from the plea-taking judge, well, you can convince me or you can convince the jury's verdict has to be unanimous, that's the only time in that plea change transcript that he asked a question. That's the only time he expressed any confusion over what he was told. And as soon as he did that, the judge repeated the bad advice. And not only that, as soon as the judge gave the bad advice, the judge did this, which, as circuit judges, you've all done. Is that true, Mr. Prosecutor? Yes. Is that true, Mr. Defense Attorney? Yes. And so what Briley Piper heard was his own lawyer affirming the erroneous advice. And so it's not any surprise that you held what you held in Piper 2. Excuse me.
You can just take that up there if you'd like.
I'd spill it. I also lost track of time. You're going to have to tell me when I'm close. That's why those two things are linked. We're not just talking about a jury waiver here. We're talking about the entire decision as to whether to go to trial on the merits or not. Now, I don't have to convince anyone, if I'm a defendant, that I have a good reason to go to trial on the merits. It's the default position. I don't have to tell you why. I can do it for no reason at all. I can do it just because I don't like authority and I'm going to make you work at this. I don't have to give you a reason. It's the default position.
Did he make this argument that he was entitled to a jury trial on the guilt phase in Piper 2?
No, I did not make that argument in Piper 2.
Okay, so we get here today because we said, in accordance with your argument in Piper 2, that he was not advised correctly as to the sentencing phase. The judge erred in instructing him, telling him about the law that applies to that. And so we remedied that. We remedied that by sending it back for resentencing in front of a jury.
Yes.
And now we're hearing that, no, what he really wanted wasn't just a sentencing. He wanted a retrial before a jury on that, too. Is that issue res judicata now because it wasn't raised last time? We remedied what he said was the problem, and now he's saying, well, no, that's not the real problem. The problem is now I want a trial. I want a trial on everything.
I will be happy to answer your question. Will you give me 90 seconds to explain why I shouldn't have to? But then I will answer it.
It's your time.
Thank you. This court's past precedent is that very argument is waived by the state if they don't raise it. It was never raised by Mr. Fitzgerald below, because if it had been raised, Mr. Piper would have received notice that he had to defend against it, and he would have received an opportunity to defend. About a month ago, I believe, Justice Severson, you wrote the opinion. There was a similar case about notice and opportunity to be heard, and it was a summary judgment motion where a judge decided it based on a ground that hadn't been raised in the summary judgment motion but had been raised in the pleadings. And this court reversed on the ground that the defendant or the loser, I don't know which side it was, civil law, but the loser had not been given an adequate notice and adequate opportunity to be heard. And that's the first answer. The second answer, of course, is the court's past precedent. I believe it's St. Cloud versus Leapley. I can give you the site if you want it, where if the state hasn't raised that below, they cannot raise it on appeal. It's been waived. The last argument is it's being raised for the very first time right now. Now, admittedly, the trial court tried to come up with some reason why it shouldn't be reached. but no one ever mentioned res judicata. And now that you gave me the 90 seconds, thank you. Now I'll give you the substantive answer to your question, which is res judicata is a prudential doctrine. It's not engraved in stone. You get to apply it if the ends of justice don't preclude it. And, well, you wrote that yourself in the Sherry O'Brien A&N case. My name didn't appear on those briefs, but my fingerprints were all over it. And so, and in Haas versus Weber, where I did write the brief and I did appear in front of this court, res judicata cannot be applied where manifest injustice would result. The same as the either the mandate rule or the law of the case thing that I talk about in my brief. That was law of the case doctrine. Very same argument. And really, how can we possibly say that, although it's a given here, that Mr. Piper was misadvised in 2001. He was misadvised in two separate ways. That's a given, because you have held that already. In 2006, you corrected one of them. Great. In 2009, you corrected the other one. Great. Now it's sent back for whatever reason, for resentencing, with language that the plea is invalid. But now, Mr. Piper is back at the posture. Again, I'm quoting from a case that you decided within the past month. It's at the procedural posture where the plea has just been entered and accepted by a circuit court judge, and it's now 1 minute later. And now we're deciding what to do about sentencing. That's where that case is at when you send it back.
And that's as to the murder charge, not to the other four non-capitals.
Well, I argue in my brief that it was a package plea. It's logically impossible to parse them. But for purposes of the argument, I'll say yes. So it's back to that point. It's the same as if you're all circuit court judges. It's the same as if you're correcting your own error. You have not accepted the plea, and you think, wait a minute. What I've told you is wrong. Let me correct that for you, Mr. Piper, and you correct the two things. Do you then give him a chance to plead anew? Or do you say, but sorry, you're shackled to your plea that was made on bad advice in a material way to you, but it was made on bad advice, but you said the magic word, too bad. My job is only to correctly advise you, and I can do it 6 years later or 8 years later, but you're still shackled to that choice.
Mr. Miller, isn't there a distinction between the advice that Judge Johnson gave as to sentencing? That's where we overturned in Piper 2, and the advice he gave as to the plea, where he said you have a right to a jury trial.
Well, that's true, but the right to the jury trial that Mr. Piper was told of was a right to a jury trial that carried jury sentencing as by operation of law, and the jury sentencing that he would get if he didn't plead guilty, where he had to convince 12 jurors. Now, only an idiot.
You know what, though? I got to interrupt you there. To follow up on that, that's not what the transcript says. And it may be a matter of context in the way we may be reading the transcript differently. But as Justice Severson, I think his point here is, I look at page 17, line 16, and let me back up 1 minute. I know a part of your case is based on the fact that you say his attorneys gave him bad advice so he wasn't thinking it through correctly as he's being advised of his rights. But it's the judge's job at the arraignment to straighten that out. And at that place in the transcript, the judge says you have the right to a jury trial here in Lawrence County by jury 12. And he's talking about the merits. He's not talking about sentencing. And then on page 18, I don't know how it can be any clearer. He says, you not only have a jury trial right as to the charge itself, as to the issue of guilt or innocence, but you have the right to a jury to determine the sentence. Now, isn't that pretty unequivocally telling him that he
sure
has a right to a jury?
Sure.
On the guilt phase?
2 minutes. Well, I don't dispute that he was told that he knew he had a right to a jury on the guilt phase and that he had a right to jury on the penalty phase. My point is that he knew they were linked, that the same arbiter had to be true for both. That's what he had been told.
But Judge Johnson didn't tell him that.
Well, Yes, he did. Judge Johnson told him that waiver of a jury was a consequence of his plea. Judge Johnson affirmed what his lawyers had told him. I mean, here's Riley Piper sitting there. His lawyers, while he's sitting there, are telling the judge, they got to be the same, they got to be the same. A half-hour break is taken to look into it. The judge knows Briley knows that because Briley's sitting right there. And the judge comes back and you don't correct it, you're all circuit court judges. What would you do? If you thought this guy has just been given horribly wrong advice in my presence and I've been told that by his lawyer, what would you do? Would you just sit there and let it go? Why are we here for the third time? Why wasn't this corrected back then? That's the second question that's just lurking around in the background, and I don't mean to criticize anyone, but really, this guy had, Judge Johnson had 2 days set aside for a motion hearing. He took a half-hour break and got it wrong. Why did he not take more? Then it gets sent back in Piper 2. What kind of a prosecutor is going to resist this, risking this third appeal? Why are we here? I mean, I'm glad you invited me back, and you're probably not going to see me again. I think this is probably my swan song. I'm getting ready to retire. But why in the world are we here again? Let's just do it right. You could poll this entire room about the death penalty. Is it right? Is it wrong? You'd get, who knows what you'd get. You'd get a sizable minority. I do know that. But if you ask this question, in South Dakota, if we must use the death penalty, shouldn't we at least make sure we do it right? How many dissenters do you think you'd get? I'll bet there's not a one on this court. And that is what's at issue here today.
Okay, thank you. Your time's expired, Mr. Miller. Mr. Swedlund, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, please, the court, counsel, aspiring counsel of our good state. The primary issue in this case is whether Briley Wayne Piper should have been permitted to withdraw his plea of guilty to the murder of Alan Pogue prior to his resentencing. The facts of this case, as this court knows, are infamous. Over the course of a 4-hour-long ordeal, Alan Pogue was assaulted with a gun, kicked, bound, poisoned with acid, kidnapped, stripped naked, beaten, buried in a snowbank, shoved into freezing creek water, bludgeoned, taunted, scalped, drowned, stabbed, stoned, and posthumously robbed. It would only shock this audience and subject Alan Pogue's memory to continuing victimization to further detail the gruesome facts of this case here today. Suffice it to say that nothing came out of Piper's resentencing that changes this court's original determination in Piper 1 that the level of torture inflicted on Alan Pogue was unprecedented in this state's history. I would like to start my argument by posing a question for this court to ponder as I proceed through. The question is this: when the record shows unequivocally that Piper understood that a hung sentencing jury would mean a life sentence for him, how does it make sense that his counsel's advice that the guilt and sentencing forms had to be the same coerced Piper to waive his jury trial? I would submit that that claim is inconsistent with the record in this case and with logic. Before reaching that question, however, I'd like to do two things. One is frame what I see as a convoluted argument into something more concise and to explain why Piper 2 is not controlling in this case. As respects his argument, Piper claims that he was entitled to withdraw his plea because it's the product of a two-step coercive process. First, the trial court's unanimity misadvice allegedly led Piper to prefer a court sentencing, which I don't think is supported by the record. Next, his trial counsel's forum-splitting misadvice led him to believe that the guilt and sentencing forms had to be the same. This allegedly pushed Piper to waive a trial by jury so that he could secure a court sentencing. Now, the unanimity misadvice found by this court in Piper 2 was a due process error. However, the alleged forum-splitting misadvice is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Now, as respects the holding in Piper 2, It's not controlling in this case for two reasons. First of all, the issues were different. And second of all, there were no due process errors contained within the court's advisements to Piper as to the consequences of pleading guilty. Now, as respects the ways in which this case is different, there are material distinctions. The misadvice at question in Piper 2 was judicial, whereas the misadvice claimed in this case is the misadvice of his counsel. Piper 2 involved the jury sentencing waiver. This case involves the jury trial waiver.
What difference does it make?
Well,
where he got the bad information? If he didn't have correct information, the plea wasn't voluntary.
Well, it's the nature of the claim, whether this is a due process or an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The judicial misadvice regarding sentencing would have had a direct influence on Piper's selection of his sentencing forum, whereas it would have had no influence on his selection of his guilt trial forum. So unlike Piper 2, the only claim of error that affected Piper's guilt forum selection decision is the ineffective assistance of Piper's counsel, rather than a due process error.
But isn't his argument that the judge didn't advise him, didn't correct the misadvice? I mean, isn't that kind of a sin of omission?
Well, this court in State versus Cobb ruled that so long as the basic Boykin rights and statutory warnings are given to Piper, as they were, then it's not incumbent upon the court to correct defense strategies. The trial court doesn't sit as an arbiter of the defense strategies.
But that may be true, but here we're looking at the voluntariness of a plea, which is due process.
Certainly, Your Honor. But the argument that Piper makes here can't be divorced from its underlying record. And what the record shows in this case is that Piper's counsel explained to him the operation of the unanimity rule. Piper knew as a matter of fact that his decision as to jury sentencing did not come with this so-called price tag of a jury that had to unanimously agree to give him life. And that sort of brings us to the question that I posed at the outset here, which is that if Piper understood the operation of the unanimity rule, how would his counsel's forum-splitting misadvice deter him from electing a jury trial as to guilt? I submit to the court that it would not, that it would, in fact, encourage Piper to select a jury trial. Because if Piper understood, as we know he did from the record, that a hung jury was his ticket to a life sentence, then he would want a jury trial so that he would have a jury sentencing. But that isn't what Piper wanted. Piper wanted a court sentencing, and that's clear if we look at the habeas transcript. The record as a whole, and the court does look to the totality of the circumstances here, shows that Piper had motivations to plead guilty that were wholly unrelated to the unanimity or alleged forum-splitting misadvice. And I don't want to concede that forum-splitting misadvice was actually given. It was a trial strategy on the part of his defense counsel to try and force the court to become the sentencer by having Piper plead to the court. But we do not concede that there was necessarily misadvice given. Piper wanted to be pled to the court and to be sentenced by the court because he wanted to be the first of his trio to plead and to appear to accept responsibility and to appear remorseful, even though we know from the record in this case now that he really isn't. And Piper also preferred a court sentencing over a jury sentencing, not because of any confusion over the unanimity or forum selection requirements, but because he felt that the gruesome facts of this case would incite the passions of 12 lay jurors against him. Thus, it's for his own strategy reasons that jury sentencing was not Piper's goal at the time he pled guilty. Piper got the proceedings he wanted. He stood to gain nothing by going to trial on the what his own counsel characterizes as the empty question of guilt or innocence, while he stood to gain everything if his strategy worked. Feigning remorse to a dispassionate sentencing court was the best card that Piper had to play. And pleading to that same sentencing judge was an indispensable part of that strategy. Piper's disappointed expectations now, 13 years and 5 days to the day that he killed Alan Pogue, are not grounds to grant him a new trial. Piper's arguments in this case are based on the misconception that the court was obligated to step in and correct what may or may not have been misadvice. We know that Piper 1 is the first decision that said that no, the forms can be split. We also know, if we look at page 94 of the habeas transcript and at page 8 of the sentencing transcript, that the court gave Piper a chance before he was to be sentenced by the court and said, again, do you want to proceed with court sentencing? The court offered him a jury sentencing immediately before they commenced the sentencing. This put Piper on notice that he could, in fact, split his forms. And if he knew that at the moment before his sentencing, then he also knew he could withdraw his plea at the time when the more favorable standard of review would have applied. As respects Piper's waiver of a jury trial, there was no error in the court's basic advisements as to the consequences of a guilty plea. So long as Piper understood the operation of the unanimity rule, which the record shows that he did, the form-splitting misadvice would not have exerted a coercive effect on his decision to waive a jury trial. In fact, the belief that the trial and sentencing forms had to be the same would have, in fact, encouraged Piper to select a jury trial if that is what he wanted. But the record shows that a jury trial is not what Piper wanted. As noted in U.S. versus Buck, to 661 F3rd 364, when a defendant admits his guilt, as Piper has, and with pathological pride and in gory detail in this case, the occasion to set aside a guilty plea seldom arises. And this case is not such an occasion. I would submit that this case is not such an occasion. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the floor to my opposing counsel.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the court? There being none, thank you, Mr. Sledlin.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Miller, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. We are not here to determine what Mr. Piper wanted back in 2001, because we all know he wasn't correctly advised then. We are here to determine what he wanted when he finally received correct advice. He finally received corrected advice in 2009 when this court decided Piper 2. Case reached the trial court, he got new lawyers, he got a different judge, and the very first motion he filed was a motion to withdraw his plea. The very first motion he filed. We know what he wanted with correct advice. We don't have to speculate. There's no reason to go back to 2001 here. We are here to talk about whether the motion to withdraw the guilty plea was properly decided. That's it. Because the advice wasn't corrected until 2009. You know, to get back to what the Constitution requires about a valid guilty plea, it must be a valid waiver of rights. And that presupposes valid advice. It can't be corrected later on. The question is whether, when the plea is entered, it's a valid waiver. In Monette versus Weber, in the habeas challenging the plea, state comes in with an affidavit or with defense attorney testimony and with the state advisement of rights that the defense attorney had him sign that shows it was voluntary and shows it was knowledgeable. And what this court held is, you know, that's irrelevant because the trial judge that took the plea didn't know about it. The trial judge has to know about it. The question is whether the trial judge's findings of voluntariness and intelligence are supported by the record that the trial judge knows. And so we're not going to consider that. Now, you didn't used to follow that rule, but you have followed that rule repeatedly since Monette. I don't know if maybe you're just tired of getting guilty plea appeals and maybe trial judges ought to tighten their standards, and you're just tired of that. I don't know what your reason for that is, but I do know what you ruled in Monette, and I do know what you ruled in the case since then. I can't remember the name of it. It was a Cindy Howard case. The question here is what whether that plea withdrawal motion should have been granted in 2010. I guess that's when he made it, or that's when it was decided. Just as an aside here, another argument I make in the brief is that it's per se an abuse of discretion if the trial court applies the wrong legal standard. And once again, you ruled that within the last month, that an error of law is an abuse of discretion, and applying the wrong legal test is an abuse of discretion. And that was decided February 20th, Ag First Farmers Co-op, 2013, South Dakota 19. That should be enough right there to reverse. But I would think you would also want to make sure this doesn't come back here yet again. And I know it's within your decisional power to reverse with specific instructions as to what to do, and those specific instructions ought to be to allow withdrawal of the guilty plea. This case is set back to the point where he hasn't been sentenced yet. All he has to do is that motion should be liberally granted, and all he has to do is come up with some tenable reason why he shouldn't be shackled to the plea that was entered 8 years earlier, 9 years earlier, based on erroneous advice. To me, that's a gimme. I don't see what the problem is. And I think we ought to insist that before we allow sentencing jurisdiction, which can result in capital punishment, to happen, we at least make sure that the pleading defendant is given accurate advice beforehand. That plea is a valid waiver only if, when it's entered, it's a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver. That knowing and intelligent can't happen later on. And this court has ruled that it's the trial court's record that determines that, not anything else. It's way too late in the day today to be relitigating Piper 2. If the state wanted to do that, they should have filed a motion for rehearing, and they never did so. It's just way too late in the day to expect Piper to have to defend against that again as well. The last thing I'd say is that the state's characterization of State versus Cobb is not accurate. In State versus Cobb, there were two issues, but the issue they're talking about is this. The defendant evidently was told, at least he claimed he was told, that his plea should be withdrawn because his lawyer told him that even though he pled guilty, he could appeal the suppression motion loss. Might have been a different motion, but let's call it suppression motion loss, which is legally untrue. And so he wanted to withdraw his plea on that ground. Well, at the plea colloquy, at the time of the plea, nothing had been said about that at all. And so this court quite properly ruled that that would be an ineffective counsel claim because the trial court knew nothing about this supposed issue. The trial court couldn't be expected to address this supposed issue because the trial court knew nothing about it, and the trial court's advice in general was accurate. Now, that's all fine if the trial court had no inkling that that issue even exists. But in this case, the trial court had more than an inkling. The trial court knew precisely what Mr. Piper had been told because the trial court was told the very same thing in Mr. Piper's presence. That's why this case is different than Cobb. I submit that a trial court has an obligation at that point to correct what it knows is materially false information that the defendant had been given. And why wouldn't we insist on that in a death penalty case? Why wouldn't we follow what Boykin says, which is courts have to be painstaking in this situation? Why wouldn't we follow what you said? I forget the name of the case cited in my brief. I believe it was from 1950, where only the most painstaking advisement will suffice. How is that met by what happened here? And even if you don't focus on 2001, even if you focus on 2010, and even if you overlook the fact that the trial court applied the wrong standard, which is reversal right there, even if you ignore all of that, and even if you focus on the merits of this, why wouldn't we insist that before we kill somebody, we give them correct advice? Now, I'm sorry in my swan song, but I just don't understand why we have to be here again. And I think reversal is just automatic in this case, and that's all I got to say.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.